It'll be interesting tonight because it's got a bunch of different parts to Isaiah 14. So we're in Isaiah 14 tonight. It's the 11th of August of 2021. And I don't know what class this is, probably the 15th or something like that class. And we're going to take a look at this because it kind of covers a whole bunch of different things. The last chapter, 13, was very specific. It was about what would happen to Babylon. And we have this cross reference in Isaiah's discussion of Babylon with the Revelation discussion of Babylon, which we've been talking about on the Sunday service. And there's all this fun sort of cross referencing. I don't know if fun is a good word, but interesting cross referencing with that. And it talked about this time of great peace at the end. And so we had this sort of view of the far future in Isaiah 13. In Isaiah 14, that kind of continues. Keep in mind as we go through it, and I've said this before, but keep in mind that these chapter divisions and chapter headings and all this stuff is created later. It wasn't written in the original scrolls like that, but people have designed it to make it easier for us to figure out. So if we want to try to reference something, we could say, hey, look at Isaiah 13, 10, or whatever. And so we have this reference system that's been around for a very long time, but it's almost like the first part of 14 is a continuation, of what we just saw. So keep in mind, if you ever read the beginning of something, it sounds like the end of what was before. That's totally fine because it wasn't really divided like that originally. But this is what the beginning of Isaiah 14 says. And I'm in the New King James Version. For the Lord will have mercy on Jacob and will still choose Israel. Now, obviously, he's not talking about the actual guy Jacob. The actual guy Jacob's been dead for many, many centuries when this is written. He's talking about Israel. He's talking about the people of Jacob, which are the Jews, which are the Israelites. And it says the Lord will still choose them and settle them in their own land. And this is a recommitment of the original, covenant that existed. And because of all the problems that have been expressed in the first 13 chapters of Isaiah, God wants to make sure that the people of Israel, don't think that he's going to abandon them completely because he's made a covenant with them. And even if they act dumb, he's still going to keep the covenant. He's still God. It's sort of like if you care about somebody and they do something bad to you, but you still keep taking care of them or caring about them or whatever. We don't stop having our kids just because the kids act crazy or do something stupid. They're still our kids. And he's still going to give them the land. So the strangers will be, now, this is when it starts to get a little weird, the next sentence. The strangers will be joined with them, and they will cling to the house of Jacob. So what happens to the majority of the Jews? What happens to the majority of them is the northern kingdom is going to be taken away. The southern kingdom is going to be taken away eventually. The majority of Jews are going to be dispersed. There's going to always be a remnant, like it said several times in the previous chapters. There's always going to be a remnant, but the majority of Jews are dispersed. And that's why to this day they're everywhere all over the world. But it has to do with what happens to them. But in the areas that they're in, one of the things that happens is they get strangers mixing with them, that various other tribes, various other peoples are going to mix together. I mean, the vast majority of Jews today are mixed with other cultures and races. That is wasn't the original plan that Jews were kind of set apart and they were supposed to stay with their own people, kind of like when they were looking for wives in the patriarchs, and they would go send them out to find somebody from the same, tribal group. But it's going to be impossible for the people that are there. that are about to get taken and scattered and all that by all these different forces, and they're going to lose all those, all that contact. So they're going to be mixing. And those people, it says those people cling to the house of Jacob. And there's many reasons for that. But one of the reasons is, don't forget that this is not that long after David and Solomon. So there was an extreme amount, like a, you know, richest man in the world type situation going on with Solomon. There is an extreme amount of wealth and power. And most of those people were centralized around that wealth and power under David and Solomon. So some of that wealth and power continues, and certainly the legend of the house of Jacob continues in other surrounding tribes. So that would be why someone would cling to the house of Jacob. So, yeah, 300 years. So then people will take them and bring them to their place, and the house of Israel possessed them for servants and maids in the land of the Lord. They will take them captive, whose captives they were, and rule over their oppressors. So this is just speaking of the ups and downs of what's happening to these people. Sometimes the foreigners are going to be their servants. Sometimes they're going to be the servants of the foreigners. Sometimes they're going to be in bondage. Sometimes they're going to have other people in bondage. And it's going to go up and down for them. Mostly down, but it's going to go up and down for them. It shall come to pass in the day of the Lord gives you rest from your sorrow. So it shall come to pass in the day the Lord gives you rest from your sorrow and from your fear and the hard bondage which you were made to serve, that you will take up this proverb against the king of Babylon and say. So we have a reference to Babylon again. We have a reference to Babylon in the previous chapter. This one is talking about bondage related to Babylon. Once again, remembering that we're way before Babylon comes. Assyrians are in power when this is written. Babylon's not even in power yet. But the Assyrians are related to the Babylonians, just like the Medes and Persians are related to the Babylonians. And so that is also a symbol for, as we've been talking about in the Revelation study, for the ways of the world. So the king of Babylon could be read as the king of Babylon. It could also be read as the king of Assyria. It could also be read as the king of any worldly kingdom. And so there's going to be a proverb or a wisdom or a song or a poem that he's going to give you now that's going to relate to how they're going to feel after the Lord gives them rest. So when do they get rest? Well, they get rest after the Assyrians leave. They get rest after the Babylonians leave. They get rest after the Babylonians release them back to their country. They get rest after World War II ends. They get rest after the end of the world, right? So this could be all of those time frames. So let's see if what we get from this proverb or this sort of poem that's coming up in 14:4. How the oppressor has ceased, the golden city ceased. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers. He who struck the people in wrath with continual stroke, he who ruled the nations in anger, is persecuted and no one hinders. The whole earth is at rest and quiet. They break forth into singing. Indeed, the cypress trees rejoice over you, and the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since you were cut down, no woodsman has come up against us. Now, this is obviously multi-layered, because it's talking about the golden city of Babylon, which is also a symbolic thing for the fallen world. So you've got the rulers of various rulers. It says the scepter of the rulers. So various rulers. They rule out of anger. They rule out of pride. They rule out of greed. And they're wicked. And their staff has been broken. Their scepter has been broken. And the world has grown quiet. The whole earth is at rest and quiet. That sentence is probably, not only is it the celebration that comes after they escape Assyrians and Babylonian problems and World War II and everything else, but in the medieval ages, there was a Spanish Inquisition. I mean, they were always escaping from some kind of wicked ruler trying to crush them. But the only time the whole earth is going to be at rest and quiet, really, if that sentence is to be taken absolutely literally, then that would be the end when, you know, the new heaven and new earth exists. We're definitely still within that same metaphor of the forest being cut down, etc., that we've had the last few chapters in Babylon. Now, listen to what this says, because it's getting ready to get a little crazy, okay, like Isaiah tends to do. And like I told you before, I really think Isaiah is seeing from the beginning to the end of time, and I don't know how his human brain is processing, and I really can't wait to find out a little more detail. But he's about to talk about some really unusual stuff. But let's finish this section. Hell from beneath is excited about you to meet you at your coming. That's not good. It stirs up the dead for you. Now, maybe he's talking about something else, but why would hell be excited? All the chief ones of earth, it has raised up from their thrones, all the kings of the nations. They all shall speak and say to you, have you also become as weak as we? Have you become like us? Your pomp is brought down to Sheol, and the sound of your stringed instruments. The maggot, man, I don't know what to tell you. The maggot is spread over you, and worms cover you. Well, that's not good. We know that, right? That's a problem. So this is very difficult to understand, right? If you read it in two sections like that, you're like, wait a minute, is he talking to the Jews? But he just said he's going to save the Jews. And it sounds like he's still talking to the Jews about what they're... But then you realize that that's two parts of the same discussion, which started back when it said, the oppressor has ceased, the golden city has ceased, the Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers. So now we're talking about the earthly rulers who are exciting to hell. Now, this is some very fascinating theology going on. And it's biblical, but basically it's saying, you're so wicked and your kingdoms are so wicked and they're about to be destroyed. Therefore, you're going to be hanging out in hell. So hell's going to have all these wonderful new people in it. So it's very excited to greet you. Now, obviously, that's, you know, being spoken by a man of God, it's obviously, you know, a little bit ironic and definitely sarcastic. It's like saying, you're so bad, hell's going to love you. The chief ones of the earth, it has raised up from their thrones all the kings of the nations. They shall speak and say to you. So we've got dead people in hell, which, you know, that's complicated, theologically. It stirs up the dead for you and all the chief ones of the earth, and they're going to say to you, have you become like us? So this is the rulers of the world, or a warning for us, or a warning for the Israelites. But the earthly power people, the people in hell, are saying, have you become as weak as we are? Have you become like us? Are you coming down with us? Your pomp and your power is going to be brought down to Sheol. And the sound of your stringed instruments. So your party about how cool you are and your parade about how you're the big king is all going down to hell, and you're going to be covered in maggots and worms. So whatever team that is, we don't want to be on that team. But that's fascinating how that's written. Now, as poetic prophetic speech. We don't have to. Are you shivering about the thought of maggots and worms? Yeah, maggots. That not cool. It's definitely not cool. So you think about that, and you think, okay, that's not going to be pleasant. So what is really going on here? And you think, well, it's obviously a warning. It's obviously a discussion of what's going to happen to all those powerful kings that are going to take over and crush the Israelites. But we have something to think about from a theological standpoint. We don't get a lot of information in the Bible about the afterlife, right? We don't know exactly what it's like. We know what's going to happen in the end. We know what we're supposed to do now. We know how we're saved. We have a bunch of information. But what we don't have is a lot of information about in between. And we seem to be told two slightly different things, but we don't really know enough about it to rectify it. We don't really know enough about it. We're told several times that people are sleeping in the earth. And the way this would work is you would die and you would go to sleep. And then whenever the end came, you would be raised. And for you, it would be instantaneous. So you would die and instantly be in the presence of God. So if you said you die and you're in the presence of the Lord, if it happened immediately, that would be true. But also if you fall asleep and woke up 1,000 years later in the presence of the Lord, but you didn't know it, it would also be true. So this is very tricky theological stuff. It's hard to know. But we also seem to get information within the Bible that there's a lot going on out there, and people are coming and going. For instance, we have the witch that brings back the spirit of Samuel. For instance, we have Jesus taking Peter, John, and James up to the mountain by himself, becoming illuminated, and Elijah and Moses showing up and talking to him. Now, Elijah and Moses, we can say something strange about angels or about Jesus, but Elijah and Moses are humans. So the fact that they can show up, or that Samuel can show up, or whatever, indicates that some of those people are still going around. Plus, one or two people are taken up straight away and don't ever die. So where do they go? And then every time we see the throne room, there's people in it and things going on in it. And now we have multiple types, you know, of understandings of the other side. And here we get both words, hell and Sheol. And these words are for the underworld. And almost every culture in the world has had some type of understanding of an underworld. And whenever I have questions or doubts, I turn to Jesus for answers. And Jesus has something very interesting happen that's very specific. He's dealing with a bunch of demons, and they're in this guy who lives in these rocks and cuts himself with rocks and hurts people who come around. And he talks to the demons directly, and they say that their name is Legion, that means there's lots of them. And we know that there's sometimes lots of demons in people. You know, Mary Magdalene had 9 demons in her, and he cleaned her, and that's why she was such a loyal follower. But in this case, he pulls the demons out, and this is the interesting part. They say, do not send us to the bad place. We don't want to go back there. It's horrifying there. Can you put us in those pigs instead? So the concept here is that somewhere, in some form or fashion, there is some type of hell going on now. Now, what we consider eternal fire and torment is the pit at the end of time that everything is thrown into, where they're tortured and burned forever. That's different than what Sheol or the current concept of hell would be. And interestingly enough, in that part of Revelation, it says hell is thrown in. So that would mean that all the people or demons or whatever it was that were in that hell will be thrown in. So this is very difficult to fully comprehend philosophically or theologically or even literarily. It's quite difficult to comprehend. But it seems that there is some type of place where some of the kings of the earth, where some of the bad people of the earth are going. Whether they're tortured there or held there is up for discussion. Whether that story about the rich man and, there's several stories that seem to be just like stories that Jesus is telling or someone's telling. They're like, you know, fables or metaphors. So we don't know if that story involving Lazarus and the guy trying to get like a drop of water because it's so hot, we don't know if that's just like a warning story or if it's an actual story. It seems unlikely you could see each other over a gulf between heaven and hell, but it's possible. So we don't really know. But this seems to indicate that there is a place where bad people go, and that place has people in it, and they're talking to the people that are coming down, going, hey, come on down. You know, we're excited to see you guys. That whole Babylon thing was cool, you know. Now, that's pretty tough and pretty interesting, and Isaiah will do that to you. But when we think about how that might work, is it fallen angels that are there? Is it demons that are there? Is it bad people? It seems to be a mixture in some way, and we know that the place that we're talking about when they open up the gates and they open up the door in Revelation and let the demons out, we know that that's a place, and that might be the place that the guys that wanted to go in the pigs were talking about. So this could be a story about why you don't want to be, you know, part of the world and part of these bad people. But then the next section tends to give us a little bit understanding that it's maybe broader, because we get to 14:12. And 14:12 is kind of a big deal because you don't get a lot of descriptions or discussion of this particular person in the Bible. And here's one of the main ones. And Isaiah and God through Isaiah has the following thing to say. How you have fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you are cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation, on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit. Wow. Okay. It's extremely clear that we're talking about hell, and it's being called Sheol or hell and the pit again, and it's being ruled by Lucifer. So we have in these passages a very similar description of these things that we got as kids. It's a very similar understanding. But in this passages here, you get to see one of our best descriptions in the Bible about what we're talking about. In addition, we have several other key words that are just fascinating. First of all, we get the word stars of God, and that relates directly to Revelation again. I'm sure that people have written really intense books about this, but the amount of interconnectivity between Isaiah and Revelation is just stunning. And even the same terms and concepts are being shared. It's very, very interesting. It's very interesting. And we talk about stars in Revelation, and we've talked about them being angels or perhaps being the leaders of churches or the chosen people of God, or, you know, it relates to actual stars. And it's basically, you want to be above the heavens. You want your throne above the heavens, which is where God's throne would be, right? You get this original name, Lucifer, which is, of course, his original name was a really good name. I mean, it became known as like the ultimate bad name, right? So like Benedict Arnold, you wouldn't name your kid Benedict Arnold because of what, but Benedict and Arnold weren't bad names. They just became bad names because of Benedict Arnold. That's like the tiny, tiny little microscopic version of Lucifer, because Lucifer's name, it refers to light and being a bright, beautiful being. That's what his name means. So to have one of the brightest, if not the brightest, most beautiful being, you know, that God made, and have him turn and become the darkest, most evil thing is the ultimate irony of the universe. Like, literally the ultimate irony of the universe. But he wants to be above the clouds. He wants to rule the world. And we also get the word congregation, sit on the mount of the congregation. So this is about Jerusalem. This is about the church. He wants to rule the church. He wants to rule the world. He wants to be above the stars. He wants to be above the angels. He wants to be above heaven. He wants to rule everything. He wants a throne above everything as the Most High. But instead, he'll be brought down to hell, to the lowest depths of hell. That is fascinating that we get that kind of insight into the world of the devil, right? The world of Lucifer, because that's unusual that we get that type of insight. And it's going to continue. Those who see you will gaze at you and consider you, saying, "Is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world as a wilderness and destroyed its cities, who did not open the house of his prisoners?" So, I don't know exactly how this is going to work, or if it does work, or if it's just, like I said, metaphorical language, or perhaps prophetic or poetic language. It could just be saying in a beautiful, elegant, poetic way, "You're brought really low." But it's talking about the devil in chains, basically, or down at the lowest pit, and other people looking at him and going, you know, "Is this the guy that everybody was scared of? Is this the guy that ruined the world? Is this the guy that did all this damage?" Because all the damage to the world, all the destruction, you know, pain, suffering, death, cancer, I mean, all the hardcore problems of the world that make the world so miserable are from the devil. So he's sort of the master of creating deceptions and diseases and death, and he's sort of the in charge of all the bad things, and that makes the world tremble. And when he's down in that pit, everybody's going to say, "Why is he the one? Why are we so worried about that? Why was he allowed to do? Why did he do anything?" 14:18. "All the kings of the nations, all of them, sleep in glory, everyone in his own house." So all the kings of the nations. So this is obviously future stuff. All of them, it repeats all of them, which is interesting. "Sleep in glory, everyone in his own house. But you are cast out of your grave like an abominable branch, like the garment of those who were slain, thrust through with a sword, who go down to the stones of the pit, like a corpse trodden underfoot. You will not be joined with them in burial, because you have destroyed your land and slain your people." And this is very difficult to fully understand, because this is like high-level poetic prophetic speech. But we're talking about the whole world, and we're talking about the kings of all nations. So we very well could be talking about the end times and him being taken down to the bottom of the pit forever. We could also be talking about the early times when he first fell. And he turned everyone against each other and started all this trouble, because he could be thrown down into what you call hell now. So we have this very difficult job of trying to understand the current state of evil in the world, because we've got a very evil filled world, and we've got a whole lot of demons running around the world and influencing a lot of bad things. But we also have a place where they stay that's bad. This has led some people to think that maybe we're in hell. Now, let me explain what that concept means. It would mean that the place that we are on earth as a physical place is physically the world that we're living in. But the other side of that coin is, in conjunction with this world, is a spirit world. And in this spirit world is where the demons and angels and everyone are moving around. And within that world, there would be a pit or a place of pain where these people would be imprisoned. Somewhere there's a prison because Jesus visits it when he's dead. Between the crucifixion and resurrection, he visits prisoners somewhere. They're not earthly, right? We don't know if those prisoners are the angels who fell or if those prisoners are some of the angels who took place in the activities before Noah that created the Nephilim. This is all very difficult to understand. But he does visit them and minister to them. Why would he minister to them? Unless they could be saved, maybe, which would be interesting. Could angels be saved? Now, this is a fascinating concept. Most people believe not, because they don't think that the angels have the same type of souls and the same type of activity that we have. And since they're immortal beings, if they make a decision like turn against God, it's a permanent decision. Being immortal beings and having sort of a, 10,000 year lens to look through, they could probably make the final decision. Decision would be final. But that's not 100% necessarily the whole truth. I don't know. That's way outside of our scope of understanding. But if an angel that had fallen originally, we know they're individuals and we know they have names and personalities. If an angel that fell originally went back to God and fell on his knees and cried and said, "Please forgive me," is it possible that he would do that, or she, or whatever? Or is it possible that, that's not possible? I mean, what's going on outside of here? I mean, we don't know. We don't know. But wouldn't that? I mean, it should theoretically, because God is a forgiver. That's the whole core and essence. So maybe when Jesus died on the cross, he went and told everybody, "By the way, I died on the cross, and it's a finished work, and now salvation is available for anyone who will come to me and believe in the truth of the gospel." And maybe some of those demons in chains went, "I would like to do that now," And of course, you can see their heart, and maybe they don't have the same kind of heart we have. Maybe our heart and our question marks and the things we have, because we're living beings, maybe it's different. We're a trinity in and of ourselves. We have a spirit and a mind and a body. Maybe that is the image of God, and maybe they're not, because maybe they don't have that. Maybe they don't have the full trinity image of God, or the ability to do that. I don't know. We're way outside of the scope of, standard textual analysis. But to me, it's fascinating. There's all these little tidbits like that in the Bible, like these little tidbits that just have you go, like there's a passage that says, "Not all will sleep." Here's another one. The people were getting rid of demons and healing people, and the disciples began to do that. They were getting rid of demons and healing people. They came upon one, and they brought this person to Jesus. Okay, some of the people did. And this, I think it was a little girl, had what was called a mute spirit in her. And it was a demon that was mute and made her foam at the mouth and flop around and act like totally crazy, kind of like The Exorcist or something. And Jesus spoke to the demon. It wasn't easy. Jesus spoke to the demon, and the demon left, and he fought back, gave her a huge bunch of thrashing, and then left. And fought back against Jesus and then left. And she laid there dead, like she was dead. And then Jesus had to go over and pick her by the hand and pick her up, so we don't know if she might have actually been dead. And they were like, "We don't understand. Why couldn't we get rid of that demon like all the other ones?" And Jesus said, "This kind only comes out by prayer and fasting." In other words, you weren't skillful enough, or you weren't in enough prayer and fasting to get that demon out of there. There's, you know, you'd have to do more prayer and fasting, and be a whole lot. It'd be a whole lot bigger deal to get that demon. And I read that and go, so there's different kinds of demons, for sure, which means there's probably different kinds of angels, and we have relatively good reason to believe that. But so maybe some of them are in chains, maybe some of them are down in the pit, maybe some of them are rolling around the world doing bad stuff. Maybe it's different kinds. I know that when people come under attack, sometimes that attack is a simple little annoying spirit whispering stupid crap in your ear. And sometimes that attack is a full-on destroy your life, inhabit you or your close relatives, end of the world type of an attack. And that's probably two different types of demons, or at least two different motivations for those demons. So anyway, like I said, that's pretty crazy. But the reason we're talking about that kind of stuff is because that's the kind of stuff in this chapter. This chapter has got really wild things in it about Sheol, multiple mentions of Sheol, hell in the pit, mentions of Lucifer, mentions of the earth trembling and prisoners. They say about him, are you the one that did made the world into a wilderness, destroyed its cities, who did not open the house of his prisoners? I find that sentence so fascinating. The last sentence is 17. Lucifer did not open the house of his prisoners. Isn't that an interesting phrase? Does it mean the demons, that he didn't let the demons out? They were prisoners, and he could have let them out but didn't. Or does it mean that the prisoners, a lot of people in prisons, are from him? He's the one who put them all in prisons, but he didn't let them out. He didn't help the people that he cursed. Isn't that a fascinating sentence? Anyway, he ends up in the bottom of this pit looking like an abominable branch, a garment of those who were slain. He looks like a garment. He's cast out of the grave like a garment of those. So he's been thrust through. It looks like he's thrust through with swords, so bloody, right? So a garment of somebody slain. They were wearing a garment. They got thrust through with a sword. So they're covered in blood. So he's a bloody, awful, grave corpse trodden underfoot. Dirty. I mean, this is not an attractive description. This is a horrifying description. You have destroyed your land and slain your people. So this person has slain the people that they were supposed to be theirs. A brood of evildoers prepare slaughter for his children because of the iniquity of their fathers, lest they rise up and possess the land and fill the face of the world with cities. It's like almost like there's a people of, like there's a people of God. It's almost like there's a people of the devil, right? It's the bad people, it's the leaders, but they're not going to win, but they have to be crushed before they rise up and fill the whole world with their people and their cities. I mean, okay, is there an answer? And the answer comes in 14:22. For I will rise up against them, says the Lord of hosts, and cut off from Babylon the name and the remnant and offspring and posterity, says the Lord. So in other words, as the bad things and different kingdoms and different bad, evil things in the world rise, he is going to rise up against them, protect people from them, protect the remnant, protect the name, cut off Babylon, cut off its offspring and posterity, and make its possession for the porcupine and marshes of muddy water. I will sweep it with a broom of destruction. That's a great line. I will sweep it with a broom of destruction. So every single time that we've had this big, long, really bad description of things that are going on, either currently or in the immediate future or in the far future from Isaiah, we always get a response from God saying, yeah, it's going to really be bad, or yeah, these people are bad, or yeah, this situation is bad, but I am not going anywhere. I am going to control the situation. I'm going to rise up against these bad people. I'm going to bring these powerful people low, you know. And now, the last couple of sections, it gets a little more specific. So Babylon has been dealt with, and that's not even here yet when it comes to the actual Babylon. So it could be the whole entire theory, or it could be multiple types of Babylon. Now we move to the next section. The Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, surely as I have fought, so it shall come to pass. And as I have purposed, so it shall stand. That I will break the Assyrian in my land, and on my mountains tread him underfoot. So now we're on Assyrians. We were on Babylonians. Now we're on Assyrians. Now they're related. Okay. It could all refer to, that group of people that comes against Israel in multiple times. But it can also be very specific. So the Assyrians do get broken in his land. This is way before this happens, and there's no way for Isaiah to know that besides this visions from God. But these Assyrians are going to become very powerful, and they're going to sweep down in there, and then they're going to be broken because God himself is going to break them. An angel is going to kill their army in the middle of the night, and they're going to be broken and go home. He's going to be, the Assyrians are going to be broken and tread underfoot. Then his yoke shall be removed from them and his burden removed from their shoulders. So the people that he has in the north that have been taken over by the Assyrians, that have been enslaved by the Assyrians, the people that the Assyrians are enslaving as they go to Jerusalem, all the people that have been put into slavery by the Assyrians over those periods of years, when he breaks the Assyrians, the yoke will be removed from their shoulders and the burden will be removed from them. And that is actually what's going to happen in the very near future when the Assyrians are broken and go home and all those Jews and all the interconnected people with them are going to be freed. This is the purpose that I purposed against the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out over all the nations. For the Lord of hosts has purposed. So in other words, he's designed a plan from the beginning, and it has a purpose. And when the Lord of hosts has purposed, it says, who will annul it? When the Lord's hand is stretched out, who will turn it back? So he's given them an assurance. Because right now, when this is being written, at the exact time that he's writing this down and teaching this and preaching this and showing this to the leaders, the Assyrians are gaining power when he's talking about this. So he's saying, okay, the Assyrians are going to gain power all over the place. Babylonians, evil, the devil. Power is always going to be developed by bad people. They're always going to get crushed. But these Assyrians in particular are going to be broken in this land. They're going to be broken. And that's what I'm saying. So the Lord is saying, that's what I'm saying. That's my purpose. That's what's going to happen. And when I say that, who's going to unsay it? And when my hand stretches out like that, who's going to unstretch it? Who's going to stop it? And the answer is nobody. Nobody stops the Lord. Nobody stops God from making a move. There is nobody. So that's the point of that. So in other words, that's your assurance. I'm telling you this, I'm going to do it, so you can be darn tootin'. It's going to be like that. And then there's a skip, and it probably should be another section, but this is talking about the year King Ahaz died, which is approximately 719 B.C. Look at this kid. He's crazy. Okay, 719 B.C., approximately. So, King Ahaz, who's in this list of all these kings that Isaiah is dealing with, in 1428, it says, this is the burden which came in the year that King Ahaz died. So, he's getting, by burden, he means that he's going to get a word from God, but it's not going to be pleasant. It's going to be a burden. And this is what that is, what that says. Do not rejoice, all you of Philistia. Now, we already dealt with Assyrians, which are coming from the far northeast. We've dealt with Babylonians coming from around the same place, okay? Now we're turning our around to the west, facing the sea, and dealing with the southwest and the areas of the Philistines, which we've been dealing with since before David and Solomon. The Philistines were always the problem. It was Goliath, the Philistines. It was Philistines that were torturing Samson in the time of the Judges. The Philistines have been on and off with their power structure all through this area, from what would be northern Israel all the way down into Egypt and inland quite a ways, but they're sea people. So they've been mostly to the west, mostly in the sea areas. There are murals of them fighting the Egyptians. There are murals of them and information of them fighting people throughout. But we know a lot of those fights were with the Israelites, and they fought multiple Israelite groups throughout the time of Judges, and then throughout the kings. And of course, that threat continues, and it's going to rise. Does this, imagine if you're Philistines and you're still doing your thing, and you've been around now for quite a few hundred years. You had trouble. You're almost knocked out multiple times from different kings and different kingdoms, mostly David and Solomon, but you kept going. Now, the kingdom that has always been your sort of nemesis, the kingdom of Israel, has fallen, and you've begun making advances in various places, kind of getting ready, and the Assyrians are going to whack them out and hurt them and take the top off of them, right? And now they're going to be really devastated, so you're going to be able to make your move, okay? But do not rejoice, all you of Philistia, because the rod that struck you is broken. In other words, because Israel or other kingdoms that have been, you know, your enemy are broken, don't quite have a party yet. Do not rejoice quite yet. For out of the serpent's root will come forth a viper, and its offspring will be a fiery flying serpent. The firstborn of the poor will feed, and the needy will lie down in safety. I will kill your roots with famine, and it will slay your remnant. Wail, O gate, cry, O city, all you of Philistia are dissolved, for smoke will come from the north, and no one will be alone in his appointed times. So, a combination of what's happened to them in the past, and they're going to be happy because they're going to be watching Israel in trouble, right? But the Assyrians are going to take over everything, and they're not going to have the protection like Jerusalem is. They're not going to have the protection of an angel. They're going to be destroyed. Now, we don't know the exact point in time that the Philistines were literally destroyed, but it's going to be around this time period. And interestingly enough, it says that their offspring is going to be destroyed, that they're going to be done, and it's their remnant is going to be slain. Now, the reason I find that important is because they really were completely destroyed to the point where we didn't know that they were even real. So the Bible taught us about Philistines, and we knew all about Philistines from the Bible. But a lot of things in the Bible we found evidence of in real life, right? Like in the world of the, you know, archaeologist or the anthropologist. So for instance, they know where Jericho is, right? They know that the Temple on the Mount has a temple. I mean, they know all this stuff, right? So you find that. But the Philistines, there was so little left that it was only in the last really 50 years. Well, think about this. This is 2,700 years ago. And these guys are so thoroughly destroyed that we didn't even find evidence of them until the last 50 years. Now we're excavating Gath and other areas where we've realized that we've found Philistines and Philistine burial sites and Philistine strongholds have been discovered. And more knowledge about the Philistines is being gained every year as the archaeologists and anthropologists and historians work on all of that. Philistines are known by a secular science now to be real and really exist. But that's recently. So, you know, back 2,700 years ago, Isaiah is explaining from God that all of Philistia will be dissolved, that they will be completely destroyed, and no one will be left. And even the remnant, even the roots, will be destroyed. And that's exactly what happened. Because we found nothing. They were like decimated beyond. I mean, we found so many things from the ancient past, like so many Pharaoh things or burial things or things from David or whatever. We found so many things. And we have found, like, nothing from Philistines. So, the way this chapter ends, what will they answer the messengers of the nation that the Lord has founded Zion and the poor of his people shall take refuge in it? So, this is saying that Philistia is going to be destroyed. The smoke will come from the north. Everything's going to be wailing. And what's the answer to all this? What's the message? The Lord has founded Zion, and the poor of his people shall take refuge in it. So in other words, even when all of this destruction happens, even when everything is decimated completely, when all the northern kingdom's gone, when all of Philistia is gone, when most of the southern kingdom is gone, when all this destruction happens, Zion, which is the holy mountain, the holy city, which is, you know, Jerusalem, you know, that holy place. The Lord has founded that holy place, which means that it's not going to be taken. And it won't. Not only eternally, it will exist because of the new Jerusalem in the end of Revelation, but in the attack from the Assyrians, it will exist. They will try to take it and they will fail. And then even in the attack of the Babylonians, it will exist. It'll be destroyed and harmed, but then they will come back. Even when the Romans come and destroy it, it'll still be rebuilt. So no matter what happens, Jerusalem's there right now. The Romans destroyed it down to a rock, just like Jesus said in 70 AD, and it's still there, right? It never goes away. It's been destroyed. The temple's been completely destroyed multiple times. The entire city's been completely destroyed multiple times. Over and over again. It's been overrun completely. There were no Jews there for hundreds of years. I mean, it's been overrun and destroyed over and over and over again, and yet there it sits. And will always. Because God made it. God made that Zion. He picked it. That's the holy city. That's the way it is. And it's there today. You can go get a flight, as long as you have a mask, and you can go over there and look at it and stare. It's going to be there. And if somebody blows it up with a nuclear weapon, it's going to be rebuilt. It's never, ever going to be gone because it's God's holy city. And eventually, it'll be an eternal holy city when God turns it into the new Jerusalem and the heaven and the earth are all remade in a new way. So this one is a very long, hard sort of chapter that we're in right here, because it starts off with the Lord's going to have mercy on Jacob, and then you go through what's going to happen to Babylon, Assyria, and Philistia, and all that's really bad. So I think if you summarize the whole thing, what you would have to say is that it starts off saying there's going to be mercy, and the mercy is going to happen, because it ends by saying there'll be this holy city, there'll be Zion. So you go from God will have mercy on Jacob and Israel, and there will always be a Zion. And in between, this is what happens to all the enemies. Babylon, the actual kingdom. Babylon, the concept. Assyrians. bad people, demons, the devil. I mean, the fact that the devil's in here is an indication that he's kind of covering all the enemies of Zion, whether they're gigantic and eternal or whether they're a specific thing like Assyria or Philistia. But if you think about the biggest enemies ever, who are the biggest enemies ever? Assyria is going to take out the northern kingdom. Babylon's going to take out the southern kingdom. Philistia has been the main problem through all the judges and the kings, right? So all these are what these are all the main enemies. And then, of course, you have the big enemy, the king of darkness, that's basically running all the enemies. So you have all the enemies listed. And what happens to all of them? They're all destroyed. God will rise up against them and destroy them, all of them. And the poor of his people will resettle. Think about that. And I'm not saying that Isaiah is specifically talking about right after World War II. But the poor of his people, this could be the refugees returning from Babylon. This could be the refugees leaving concentration camps and going there in the 40s. But the poor of his people are going to take refuge in it. And they do to this day. I mean, it kind of covers everything. He hasn't got to the final king, so we've got King Ahaz dying. And he's got more to come. We're only in chapter 18 out of 66, so there's plenty more to come. But this is sort of dealing with all the enemies of God's people. When we get to 15, they're going to keep going. And the fact that they went Babylon, I want to mention one more thing because it's really weird. They went Babylon first, then Assyria, then Philistia. So it's like he's going backwards in time. Babylon is in the future. Assyria is currently, and Philistia is really the past. And now he's going to go back in the next few chapters into like Moab. I mean, he's going to keep going back to anybody that has been an enemy of the people. They'll deal with, Moab or Syria or Israel or Damascus. He's basically going to talk about everyone over the next few chapters, everyone that's ever caused a problem. And when we get to chapter 18, he's going to talk about Ethiopia. So I'm going to have to deal with that because, I mean, he's going to go way out there to deal with all these attacks and all these problems. And we're going to end up dealing with Egypt. I mean, pretty crazy. So by the time we get into later September and November, October, November, we'll be dealing with Ethiopia quite a bit. And that seems very strange because what we know of Ethiopia in the New Testament is the Ethiopian that Philip baptized. What we know of Ethiopia in the modern world is one of those African countries that has, it's trying to come up. They have a pretty good airline. It's probably the best airlines in Northern Africa. But what does Ethiopia mean back then in BC? And it's part of the greater Egyptian empire. A lot of the Egyptian pharaohs are Ethiopian. So you'll have that kind of interconnectivity. But he's going to talk about, by the time we're in the end of chapter 20, he's going to be talking about Sargon, who's like the earliest emperor in the entire Mesopotamian region, like 5,000 years ago. And all these people that from basically every corner of the world, basically, that came against his people. It's fascinating. But anyway, so we're going into a section now, after we've got all this information about how it's all going to end and how Jesus is going to come, and then he's going to come again. There's going to be this time of ultimate peace on the earth. And all these bad guys are going to be taken care of in this in hell, basically. We've got that information, and now he's going to work his way through. And this has got to be, at the time, a very interesting thing, because he's going to be talking about a whole lot of stuff that he probably shouldn't necessarily know, and a lot of stuff that people around him might not necessarily know, because he's talking about a really multiple thousand years worth of histories of different kinds. And so it's stretching way back and way forward. It's almost like he's looking at all the time from the beginning to the end. It's fascinating to me. But we'll take off the next 3 weeks, two of them for vacation and one of them for so is it the 7th or the 8th? That's the first of September that we come back. Is it the 7th or the 8th? Second Wednesday, because I know the first Wednesday is the 1st, isn't it? The 8th. All right, so we'll be back here the 8th of September. Does anybody have any questions about what's been going on? It was a very complex chapter, and it dealt with, even though it was kind of easy to read, it's not easy to understand. And it dealt with all the kings that are causing problems, including the big king causing problems, the leader himself of the bad guys. It dealt with all of that, and it does not go well for them. It gave Andy the shudders at one point. But he's going to sweep it with a broom of destruction. And so, as usual, it's very bad, scary stuff, but we always get a positive message. There's always this core, and the poor of his people will take refuge in Zion. The Lord has established Zion. So previously in this chapter, it said, if I've purposed it, if I've set it up, who's going to annul it? Who's going to stop it? Nobody. It ends with, I founded Zion. And you can interpret that to say, who's going to get rid of it? Nobody. You're not going to stop God's outstretched hand. You're not going to stop his purpose. And if he created Zion, you're not going to be the one to destroy it. So that's pretty deep stuff. You definitely don't want to be covered in worms and maggots. That is so gross. All right. Okay. Well, we're just a little couple minutes early, not too early, but let's pray, and then we can call it a night, and I'll see you guys on the 8th of September. Okay. Lord, as usual, we are so grateful, and we come before you with open hearts and just full of gratitude for this chance to study your word, for this chance to have a place to do that. We're so grateful to be able to come together in a group and talk to you know, about you and about the word freely. And we want to thank you for that and all the wonderful blessings that we have here in our lives. Lord, I want to pray a special blessing over everyone here and protection for all those folks who are normally here that are out there traveling, whether it's Burl and Karen or Randy and Sharon or whoever it happens to be. Please bless and protect them. Keep them safe. Get them back here safe. Bless everyone here. Keep their health strong. Heal them in their bodies. Protect their minds and hearts. Make them stronger. Draw them closer to you. Give us all a chance to know you better. Thank you for this time, and give us more time together and in your word. Bring everyone back safely for church services and for more Bible studies. Keep them safe through our break. Secure us as we travel, me and my family, when we go on planes and over other places. Keep us safe. And as everyone here travels around and does their daily chores and their jobs and whatever they're doing, keep them safe and close to you. Bless us all mightily. Protect us in wonderful ways, and protect us from things we don't even see. Because we trust in you with all of our hearts, and we love you with all of our hearts. We pray these things in the mighty, matchless name of Jesus Christ. Amen.